A group of researchers in South Florida are working to find the vaccine for the coronavirus. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The Scripps Research Institute in Jupiter is one of many around the globe trying to find a way to stop COVID-19.
All of us need to be alert to the possibility there might be outbreaks here in the United States.
And how many people have Florida health officials tested for the coronavirus? And is the state ready if there's an outbreak? Also, it was a decade ago when the BP Deepwater Horizon oil rig exploded, sending millions of gallons of oil into the Gulf of Mexico. One scientist is looking at how 10 years later, that accident is impacting fish all the way into the Florida Keys. Finally, a new study from FAU shows more teens are being bullied online than ever before. And you'll be surprised as to which group is getting the worst of it. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Good news out of China today regarding the coronavirus. The New York Times reports for the second consecutive day, the country has seen a major reduction in the number of new cases. There are more than 70,000 cases of the virus in China and across the globe, but a very small number of them are here in the United States. Florida officials have begun testing for the coronavirus, but they won't say how many people have been tested thus far. Earlier this morning, we spoke with Samantha Gross, state government reporter for the Miami Herald and the Tampa Bay Times. Samantha, when did Florida start testing people for the new coronavirus?
So in late last month, late January, Miami International Airport started screening travelers for potential cases of COVID-19 or the novel coronavirus. And we don't really know, you know, how many people are have been tested. We don't know a lot of details about testing, but we do know that they were screening travelers last month and that early last week, the state had received testing kits to start testing for coronavirus in state labs.
Why aren't state health officials saying anything about those tests?
So state health officials are citing a state administrative code that basically says that all information during epidemiological investigations are confidential and are only released at the, you know, determination of the state surgeon general. So they're saying that unless the disease is highly infectious or there's a potential for further outbreaks, that this information is not going to be released. And because the risk for coronavirus in Florida is considered low by the CDC, they are not releasing much information at this time. So that's what they've told us.
There are also concerns about the accuracy, as you kind of touched on there, of the CDC-issued kits. Do questions remain about how effective those kits are?
Yeah. So my colleague at the Miami Herald, Ben Konark, he wrote a story about this, that the CDC had sent testing kits to Florida, but the kits were not super accurate. The labs were flagging inconclusive results, which means the results were either positive nor negative. So the state has been sending samples to the CDC labs in Atlanta for the time being until better kits are sent here so we could test in, you know, the state labs that are in Jacksonville, Tampa, and Miami.
We went through the Zika scare. Did that shape the way state health officials would handle the spread of another virus?
Yeah, so the state surgeon general, Scott Rivkees, kind of touched on this yesterday when he presented about coronavirus in front of senators at the Capitol. He had said that with the Zika scare, because mosquitoes can fly and there's kind of this risk of being affected by the virus no matter where you are, the state really took control and they were releasing very timely data every day about how many people were being tested, how many cases there were, what areas, you know, these cases were being found. And I think that the state has kind of learned that outbreaks like this, you know, are a big cause of concern for a lot of people. And so this time around, there are 700 people actually on a special team that's supposed to be kind of keeping an eye on the coronavirus. So I think that the Zika scare has kind of shaped the way the state has, you know, try to take action earlier than later and keep a close eye on, you know, any sort of developments.
Senator Rick Scott, as little information U.S. officials have received from China about the coronavirus, what's he angry about?
So Rick Scott is angry about the information or the, you know, lack of information that the U.S. has received from China. I think that he just wants more transparency is what he's been saying. There are definitely concerns over how much information China is sharing with the U.S. There are reports that the, you know, knowledge of the coronavirus has existed for a lot longer than I think some people initially thought. And I think that people in the U.S. are, you know, critical of China for, you know, not releasing as much information as they would like. So I think that a lot of, you know, others are, you know, hoping for some more information.
There are known cases of coronavirus in the United States, none in Florida so far. But how prepared are hospitals here in the region if they had to respond to an outbreak?
So I had heard yesterday from the Safety Net Hospital Alliance of Florida, which has many, many member hospitals across the state, that they're working closely with the State Department of Health, the Centers for Disease Control, and the World Health Organization to prepare. So they regularly do drills to prepare for patient surge situations is what they told me. And they're currently implementing protocols to kind of identify risk factors for new patients, you know, keep an eye on recent international travel and preparing to isolate potentially infected patients. So they have, you know, protocol that they're following. And the State Health Department has also sent advisories to all healthcare providers in Florida, basically saying that if there are patients that, you know, could be at risk for this virus, that they need to be, you know, properly tested, they need to be properly treated, kind of, you know, monitored until testing results come back.
So in the legislature yesterday, the issue of the coronavirus came up, but state health officials actually argued about another virus that was of greater concern. They were talking about the flu.
So yesterday, state lawmakers received a presentation from a Tampa General Hospital physician, John Sinnott, who told them influenza is the elephant in the room. You know, no one's talking about it, but it's killing people. And he had cited some statistics that 350,000 people have been hospitalized this year or during flu season this year. And there have been 25,000 deaths that have been flu related. And obviously, you know, those numbers trump any sort of coronavirus effect in the United States. And I think, you know, they were kind of trying to get out the word that it's really important for people to take note of the flu as well. And, you know, wash their hands, get flu shots, be, you know, cautious of flu symptoms and things like that. You know, coronavirus can be spread when people sneeze or cough or, you know, shake hands with somebody. But the flu is really contagious. And during flu season, you know, Americans are at risk.
And those numbers you gave, those are national numbers.
Those are national numbers. Yes, not in Florida.
Samantha Gross, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Lewis.
Again, that was Samantha Gross, state government reporter for the Miami Herald and Tampa Bay Times. You could find her story on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Well, staying on topic, researchers are developing antiviral medication to treat the coronavirus, as well as a vaccine to prevent it from spreading. And some of that work is being done here in South Florida. Dr. Michael Farzan is the co-chair of the Department of Immunology and Microbiology at the Scripps Research Institute in Jupiter, Florida. We spoke with Dr. Farzan yesterday about their ongoing research. Dr. Farzan, how would you compare this coronavirus relative to other outbreaks that you've researched in the past, like SARS or the avian flu?
So this is an outbreak very, very similar to the SARS outbreak, meaning that it's driven by a similar virus, and in fact, a close cousin of the SARS coronavirus. This particular virus appears to be more easily transmissible, but happily cause less severe disease in general.
What do we know at this point? I mean, you say that it's a cousin to another virus that we already know. Does that mean that we really have a jump on it? Or, I mean, really still, are there a lot of questions? Is there a lot of mystery to this?
Both. We have a large amount of insight into how what the virus looks like, how it behaves in general, what its mechanism replication is, and how it gets into cells. And that was built on work done during and after the SARS outbreak back in 2003. We still have a lot to learn about the particular characteristics of this virus, in particular, what its real severity is, how it transmits, and of course, whether it's going to cause serious disease here in the U.S.
So researchers are working on an antiviral to help those who are infected and a vaccine to prevent it from spreading. Let's start with the antiviral. What are the Chinese using right now for treatment?
Well, the Chinese are using several different stopgap treatments. Some of them come from the category of approved HIV drugs. And as far as we can tell, they should not be especially effective. There are new drugs coming on that have been tested in animals against very similar coronaviruses that have shown to be effective in the early stages of those coronavirus infections. And those may be more promising. And there are other drugs, including a series of drugs that are emerging out of Scripps research here in Florida, that will also slow down the virus.
I wanted to come back to the first thing you said. They're using HIV drugs. Why?
They use that which is available. And so the first thing that one can try are things that are manufactured and available and readily distributed. And these are HIV protease inhibitors. The coronavirus has similar kinds of proteins, but as far as we can tell, they should not be especially active against the coronavirus proteins.
What is the Scripps Research Institute doing right now in the area of antivirals?
In the area of antivirals, we're drawing on really a very good resource of ours, which is a library of 14,000 compounds, all of which have been tested as and shown to be safe in humans. So they are not necessarily drugs, but they all have been shown to be have no side effects in humans. And we're using that library to test against several viral processes that the virus needs to replicate, including how it gets into cells and how it is processed once it's in the cell, to see which of these 14,000 compounds can be effective against these processes.
There have been a number of research facilities in the U.S. that have developed pilot antivirals that appear
yes.
successful in limited testing. But so there's optimism about a drug that proved successful, for example, in the spread of the MERS outbreak back in 2012. Is it that easy? Can you use drugs that treated other respiratory viruses effectively in treating coronavirus, again, because they're cousins?
Yes. The current virus is a close cousin of the SARS coronavirus and a more distant cousin of the MERS coronavirus. Compounds that work against each of these may be effective against the current coronavirus. I should say that our large challenge now is not identifying compounds that are effective, but rather manufacturing and distributing those compounds in a way that can be useful in the next few months.
Yeah, how fast can we get these antivirals out into the market?
That remains to be seen. Under normal processes, it would take months or years. There are certainly efforts to accelerate those processes, so it is possible that some of the early proven drugs may be available in a matter of months, but it's unclear whether that will be fast enough.
That's because it has to get a federal approval, right?
Federal approval is just one step. So we need to make sure that the drugs are safe in humans, and we can do that rather quickly. But then we need to manufacture and distribute the drugs in a way that can be useful to people around the country in the world who might be affected.
So you get through all those processes, and then, of course, you have to get it into China. Do you see that as easy, or do you think the Chinese would put up roadblocks?
Oh, no. I think that right now the lead drug, the one that you mentioned that is effective against both SARS coronavirus and MERS coronavirus, is already going to be tested in China. China's initiated 82 separate clinical trials on similar drugs or approaches that might be effective.
I'm talking with Dr. Michael Farzan, the co-chair of the Department of Immunology and Microbiology at the Scripps Research Institute in Jupiter, Florida. You could read more of our coverage of the coronavirus by going to WLRN.org. So we talked about the antivirals. Let's talk about vaccines. What are the challenges when trying to come up with a vaccine, to battle something we don't have all the answers to?
Well, the good news is because of our work the work at Scripps and at other places on the SARS coronavirus, we know a good deal about how one would generate a vaccine against this particular virus. And the further good news is that it's a relatively easy virus to vaccinate against, in contrast, for example, to HIV or even flu. So that's the good news. The bad news is that it takes a good deal of time to manufacture, again, these kinds of vaccines and distribute them, test them and distribute them. So our main challenges are not scientific, in which we think we can be done in a matter of months with the initial evidence that a vaccine can be effective, but our main challenges are manufacture and distribution.
From the very beginning, the Chinese leadership has been very tight-lipped about what's really happening. And I'm wondering if on the scientific level, it's the same. I mean, are you getting enough information from Chinese doctors and the Chinese government as to what's going on so that that helps you in your research?
I would say that the Chinese scientific community has been an open sieve, that they have been very clear about what they understand to be going on. Obviously in contrast to the government.
What's the role of the World Health Organization playing in this? What have they done so far?
Their role is as sort of a guide and mediator among a lot of different cross currents, some of them useful and some of them counterproductive. So first and foremost, they've been a source of accurate as possible information. And I hope they are guiding our both research and pharmaceutical efforts toward solving this problem.
Let's go to the beginning when the first story started to come out of China about this coronavirus. And, you know, again, very small numbers at the time, but all of a sudden there was a question of, is there a problem? Is there a situation? Usually in that case, when does information start getting to researchers and scientists to start looking into it so they could see, okay, what if this grows, then we're ready, or we could start working on it now?
Right. So the most important information that was made available to us early was the genetic sequence of the virus. And that was made available to us in early January. And that is remarkable considering even the SARS coronavirus, it took several months before we got the genetic sequence of the virus. And in contrast to HIV, back in the 80s, it took years to get the genetic sequence. So that's a remarkable achievement and a very important piece of information for scientists, indeed the most important piece of information for scientists. So that was, as I say, made available very, very quickly. Since then, because of that genetic information, there has already been a huge amount of accomplishment, scientific accomplishment, and in particular, the structure of the protein that mediates the entry process into the cell has been solved already, again, in an incredible record time, and allowing vaccine designers and drug designers at it. Pieces of the amount of information that is invaluable.
So from what you told me earlier, the real challenge then is, again, to make sure that we go through the process of testing it on humans. We know that it's safe, that it could work. But then I'd also imagine mass producing it and distributing
it. Right. And I think where we need to direct more resources in the future as we learn our lessons from this one is that the scientific contribution is very, very fast, but we need mechanisms to accelerate our manufacture and distribution of vaccines and cures better than what we have in place now.
Help me help the news media understand what is the best way to communicate to the public about the level of concern that we should have without causing panic.
I think that the best way to say that is that even the most accomplished epidemiologists around the world don't yet know whether this is going to be a serious concern, whether there'll be an outbreak in countries like the United States. But if there is, most of us will find that to be inconvenient. However, about 1 in 50 to 1 in 500 of us will have more serious disease that we will need to address and protect from.
And we see so many images coming from China, people locked up in their homes. In many cases, cities look abandoned. And people, those who are walking around wearing masks, preventative measures that the Chinese are taking, is that the right way to go about it?
I think so, because although they look draconian, they're slowing down the rate at which the virus is emerging from China. And that is giving us a window of opportunity to address the problem before it gets serious in other countries.
When you think back to the SARS, you know, your facility was a key research facility in working that outbreak. Again, what did we learn from that that's helping us now?
First of all, we learned how the virus needs to get into the cell, and therefore how to make a vaccine that would prevent it from doing so. And I think that's the number one contribution of the previous outbreak. We also, in the meantime, have developed compounds that can stop various processes that the virus needs to replicate. And so both of those can be applied here. Again, it's all the logistics and the manufacture that are limiting us. So science can be very, very fast now, and very impressively fast. But we need to get the manufacturing and distribution up to that level as well.
Again, that was Dr. Michael Farzan, a director at the Scripps Research Institute in Jupiter, Florida. The Institute is giving a series of public talks about the work of their researchers. There's one today focused on neurological diseases. Dr. Farzan will be presenting on the coronavirus later in April. And you can find more information on our website at WLRN.org. Well, still to come, a new study on the massive BP oil spill found that the effects are still being felt all the way in the Florida Keys 10 years later. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. A decade ago this April, the world watched a catastrophic scene unfold in the Gulf of Mexico. The BP Deepwater Horizon oil rig exploded, killing 11 workers and injuring 17 others. Deep beneath the surface, millions of gallons of crude oil shot out into the ocean. It's still the largest oil spill in U.S. history. Do you remember where you were when that happened? Scientists have been studying the impacts of the oil on marine ecosystems over the past decade. A new study from the UM Rosenstiel School of Marine and Atmospheric Sciences finds the impact of the spill is much greater than original projections. Oil has likely contaminated marine life all the way into the Florida Keys. Professor Claire Paris is a senior author of the study. She joins me now in studio. Claire Paris, such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Take me back 10 years to when this happened. I remember I was living in the west coast of Florida when it was happening, working at WGCU in Fort Myers. You were here in Miami, but take me back to that. What was it like? What were you feeling as you saw all of this happening?
Yes, it was kind of like incredible, because at first we thought this is going to stop within the next few days, and every day was more oil coming to the surface. So at that time, I was already a professor at the University of Miami, and I had developed a model to track plankton in the ocean. And this model was used to look at the dispersion of the oil at the surface. But I realized quickly that this was not a regular oil spill. It happened 1,500 meters, 5,000 feet below the sea surface. So there is a portion of the oil that we see at the surface because the oil is buoyant and rises to the surface, but it was not so obvious to me that you could use just a model tracing in two dimension the oil spill.
I think about the fact, and I was mentioning to you before the segment, is that, look, 10 years have passed, and, you know, I don't know, but I'm wondering, like, how much of that oil is still in the water? Has it dissipated? Where is it gone? What do we know?
Well, this is a part of the reason why we are examining these questions now with this new study, because we were tasked to look at the effect of the oil spill on fisheries and more of the socio-economical impact of the fishery closure with a National Academy of Science grant. And when we looked at the fishery closure and compared that to the model that we had developed throughout these 10 years, we saw that the model was predicting oil beyond the fishery closure. And so we wanted to understand whether or not there was really toxic oil beyond the fishery closure and whether the model was predicting the full extent of the spill.
Compared to other oil spills, this, because you touched on it a moment ago, what was unique about this one, it wasn't like, you know, the Exxon Valdez where the oil's on the surface. This is oil coming up from the bottom, and not all of it came up to the top. So it was very different. But how different was this one from all others? Was this is the worst one in U.S. history?
Yes, this is the worst one in U.S. history by, you know, orders of magnitude compared to the Exxon Valdez, which is considered the second one. One major difference is Exxon Valdez was from an oil tanker that struck a reef, so it was a surface spill of crude oil. Here we're talking about gas, saturated oil and gas that is spewing, you know, in the deep ocean under high pressure and in cold waters. So all these need to be incorporated in the model. It's not just tracing water parcel or even oil and pushing it by the wind. You have to understand the thermodynamic and more complex processes that occur when the gas expands coming out of the well.
And the other thing too is with other oil spills, we usually use satellites to track where that oil spill is going because it's on the surface. But with this one, satellites can't tell us what's happening beneath. What happened to that oil deep beneath?
Right.
What do we know?
So what we know now, and this is based not only on the modeling in three or four dimensions with time, but also based on observations, that there was a formation of a deep plume. So this deep plume
that lasted 90 days.
Yes,
it kept going for a while.
Yes, so this deep plume was at about 1,000 meters beneath the sea surface, and it was also contaminating the deep ocean where you have all the mesopelagic fish and other species that are important in the food chain and do vertical migrations on a daily basis in the ocean, so because the ocean is connected. And so this deep plume was present for the time of the spill. And you had also contamination on other parts of the water column because the circulation at the surface of the ocean is very different from the surface in the interior of the ocean.
In your paper, in your research, you talk about invisible oil. What does that mean?
So by invisible, we mean that it's invisible from the satellite footprint. And for several reasons. One is because the concentration is lower, but it doesn't mean that it's not toxic to the marine life. And these are dull sheens of oil that are not seen by the satellite. And also it's invisible because when you have a lot of wind and wave action, for example, we had the Hurricane Alex that hit the Gulf of Mexico on June 28 to July 1st. The oil disappeared from the surface, but it was still mixed in the water column and it was highly toxic.
You said something to me also, again, before we started talking, and that I thought was interesting, is that, again, we have to remember that everything in the ocean is connected. So even when you have the oil down at the bottom that's sitting down there, it's impacting marine life there, but that will eventually impact the marine life that's up top, right?
Yes, that's absolutely right, because you have in the deep ocean organisms that are feeding on the benthos, and the oil was also sedimented. A lot of oil was in the sediments. So this enters the food chain, and the toxicity of the heavy oil accumulates in the organisms.
What do we know about how far down south, past, again, because this happens near Louisiana's coast, how far down south into the Gulf of Mexico, South Florida, has been impacted by any of that oil? What do we know?
So based on the Gulf Science data that was released back in 2016 by BP, we have been able to validate the model, and this oil in the sample was found in the Florida Keys, the western shelf of Florida, a little bit in the east part of Florida coast as well, in the sediment and in the water column. It was found in the Loop Current and part of the Gulf Stream.
All these years later, all these years later still.
No, these were samples that were taken throughout the spill.
Throughout the decade, okay.
Yes.
I'm talking with Professor Claire Paris from the University of Miami's Rosenstiel School of Marine and Atmospheric Sciences. Paris is the senior author on the new study that examines the impact of the BP oil spill in 2010. It finds that the ocean areas impacted by the spill likely 30% larger than initially projected. So this comes back to, and I think I've been pressing on this a little bit because I'm wondering, how long can oil contamination have an impact on fish and other marine life? How long can we see it still in these different populations, from plankton all the way up to crabs and lobsters and shrimp and so forth?
Well, yeah, our study doesn't address that, but based on toxicity studies, we know that the contamination is still present in some of the species. If it's in the, if it's in the sediment and you have animals that are feeding in the bottom, or a large pelagic species that are accumulating this toxicity and have a life history where the population growth is slow and they don't reproduce very often, this can stay for a long time in the ecosystem.
You talk about the toxicity. How bad is it? How toxic? How high is that toxicity in some of the study, what you have found? Do we know?
So, and this is, again, a question for toxicologists. What we can say is that the toxicity that in the invisible toxic oil is large enough to affect 50% of the population of the plankton, for example. These are LC50 data on plankton. Again, I'm not a toxicologist, but this is how we parameterize basically our, the toxic portion of the oil in the model. When the plankton is affected, then the plankton is part of the base of the food chain. So we don't know, and these are good questions because there's still more studies that need to be taking into account this data.
Your research took the better part of a decade to put together. What were some of the complications in getting this published, again, considering the controversy around the oil spill?
Well, a model is always a model, and the question is how accurate the modeling is. And also, there was no relationship so far and between the satellite footprint and the concentration of oil in the water column. So it took some time working with a team of toxicologists and geochemists, fish biologists. So this is an interdisciplinary study. So it took some time also to do a review of all the work that has been done in the past 10 years to come to a conclusion and quantify the toxicity.
So the modeling that you've been able to work on and achieve, is this now really the way to look at future oil spills? This is the best way to research it?
What we propose is that obviously the satellite data is essential so far to look at the surface oil, but again, this is only the tip of the iceberg. It doesn't see the three dimension under the ocean. So to do that, we propose a framework of using water samples together with operation models to trace yield in 3D in the future. I think this will improve greatly the way we can respond to such mega oil spill. And given the fact that that oil exploration has been increasing worldwide, I think it would be wise to take into account oil that is everywhere, not only at the sea surface.
Amazing to think that 10 years later, you know what, we're still feeling the effects. And again, that was, again, the worst oil spill in U.S. history. And as you said, a lot of oil exploration going on. So always something to keep there in the back of our minds. Again, Professor Claire Paris from the University of Miami's Rosenstiel School of Marine and Atmospheric Sciences. Claire Paris, thank you so much. I appreciate the information.
You're very welcome. My pleasure.
All right, still to come, do your kids date online? We learn a lot about these platforms. They can be dangerous. We have new research from FAU coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. You know, dating as a teen is such a difficult thing to do. Do you remember what it was like? I do. It seemed so much easier, though, when I was younger, because things have changed a lot with the advent of new technologies. Social media, smartphones, I mean, they made dating that much more complicated. And it's led to different kinds of violence and bullying, unfortunately. There's a new study from Florida Atlantic University that found that a quarter of teens have reported experiencing some form of violence, specifically online. Joining me now is Dr. Samir Hinduja. He's the lead author of the study and a professor in the School of Criminology and Criminal Justice at FAU. He's also the co-director of the Cyberbullying Research Center. Dr. Hinduja, it's great to have you back.
Hey, thank you for having me.
What is digital dating abuse, and how is it different from, I guess, other forms of dating abuse?
Yeah, digital dating abuse is, you think about technology like texting or social media, and let's say I use it against my romantic partner repeatedly to harass them with the intent of controlling them or intimidating them or annoying them or threatening them. And I'd say it's different than real world violence because it's happening online. But what's interesting is that we found a strong overlap between the two.
You've worked with young boys and girls in elementary school, middle school, and high school that have dealt with digital dating abuse. What does digital dating abuse look like for different age groups, or is it the same across the board?
Well, the first thing comes to mind is, let's put me right in the center of an example. Let's say that I take my wife, Rachel, out for a date. She loves fondue, and so let's say we go to the melting pot, and she runs to the restroom, but she keeps her phone on the table. And I pick it up, and I'm rifling through her text messages and her Snapchat logs just to make sure she's not talking with another guy. Now, she shouldn't be, but it's very wrong of me to invade her privacy like that. Another example would be, we're out on date night, and I say, hey, love, I'm going to keep your phone with me in my pocket so that you're not distracted by notifications or texts that are coming in. Now, she shouldn't be, because it's date night, she should be focused on me. But it's, again, very controlling to physically possess her device. And so it could look like that. It could look like a threat in a cell phone text message. It could relate to a post that somebody makes on social media to make fun of or threaten or humiliate their partner. Could be related to a private message, a private picture, a sexual picture that you take that you've received in trust, but then you post it without permission. And so that truly can happen across different ages.
Again, you, as I mentioned, you authored this study, and it was published in the Journal of Interpersonal Violence on Digital Dating Abuse. This was interesting. It found that males were significantly more likely to have experienced digital dating abuse. Why are males more likely to experience this form of abuse?
Yeah, we found that incredibly puzzling. And so as I'm speculating, I just think about, stereotypically, we may assume that in a heterosexual relationship, you know, females, they're used to drama. They may experience more drama and conflict in their normal interpersonal relationships, let's say with other girls. And so they use the medium and the environments within technology to perhaps deal with conflict with their significant others. And so that's perhaps why males might be victimized a little bit more often.
Interesting how you describe the difference between digital abuse and, you know, the difference between physical abuse. But did you find anything in the study that tells us that digital abuse leads to physical abuse?
I had mentioned earlier that there's a strong overlap. We found that About 4 out of 5 of the students who have been targets of digital dating abuse had also been the target of traditional dating abuse. So as another real world example, let's say that I am invading your privacy and going through your phone right now because I'm insecure and jealous and I don't want you talking with somebody else. Well, it's very likely, it seems that there's a strong overlap of me possibly doing something physical to you the next day.
We talked about differences in age. Did you find any differences in race, ethnicity, or differences in, and you touched on a little bit a moment ago, on the differences between heterosexual and homosexual relationships?
Yeah, so we didn't find any differences related to race or ethnicity, but what we have found as we've studied digital dating abuse, as well as sexting and cyberbullying and some of these other issues, is that those in the sexual minority, for whatever reason, they are a vulnerable population and they tend to be involved more so as victims and even as aggressors than those who are in the sexual majority.
I wondered if you'd heard a story that, you know, from the kids that you talk to and mentor, a story that just shocked you.
Most of the stories that I've heard recently truly involve the sending of private pictures, sexual pictures or videos, which then get released. And when I get a chance to speak with youth and have that platform, I really try to encourage them that, okay, you've fallen in love. This is the best thing ever. You don't want to lose this. And you want to deepen intimacy in that relationship as well. And so you very well may want to send an image. But I have to tell you, if you just look at the statistics, in middle school and high school, unfortunately, these relationships, they don't last. And they often don't end well, even though you think you'll stay BFFs. And so when they don't end well, and when hearts have been stomped on, then there's this desire for revenge. And then those pictures and images and videos get shared. And so I would say the most frequent form of digital dating abuse that we're seeing as we work with kids has to do with the sending of private pictures and violating of trust.
I'm talking with Dr. Samir Hinduja. He is the lead author of the study, Digital Dating Abuse Among a National Sample of U.S. Youth. He's also a professor in the School of Criminology and Criminal Justice at FAU. You know what, Dr. Hinduja, I wanted to ask about really young kids, elementary school kids. What did you find in that group?
So our research doesn't specifically focus on elementary schoolers. It focuses on middle schoolers and high schoolers. But with that said, we work with elementary schoolers all of the time. And I find that from a very young age, they do want to get involved in romantic relationships. Now, of course, they don't know what they're doing, just like I didn't know what I was doing in middle school or high school. I didn't know what love is. I didn't know what commitment is. But we know that there's a lot of pressures from society and media messages and celebrity culture to get involved in a relationship. And I do remember having my first crush in third grade. And so the point here is that when it comes to a fourth grader or fifth grader, it's important to start having conversations about relationships, you know, what is healthy and what is dysfunctional. And I think that many times educators and many parents are negligent in that area because they're not really thinking about the reality of it happening.
As I mentioned, you're the co-director of the Cyberbullying Research Center, and a lot of the work the center does is about awareness. What kind of education does the center provide?
We provide a host of resources related to prevention and response because we know that many youth serving adults, whether they're educators or mental health professionals or law enforcement or parents, you know, in the community, they get freaked out when it comes to technology and social media and some of these ills that they hear about. And so we want to encourage them and empower them and equip them with research-based strategies that they can easily implement in the homes, whether it comes to building empathy or resilience or helping with moral development, just building better communication. That goes a long way in sort of preventing some of these problems down the road.
Let's break this down into two factors, parents and schools. And so let's start with parents and what you talk to parents about and what's a healthy level, I guess, of, you know, monitoring of what your kids are doing.
We want parents to be involved in the lives of their kids. And truly, that just involves communication and conversation. And I know that it's hard to have your kid pay attention to you without them rolling their eyes or running over to their device and picking it up. But if you can catch them in a captive moment, whether it's eating together at the dinner table with the devices away, I would want them to ask, hey, if you're in a relationship, how is your relationship going? And if they're not in a relationship, then they can say, hey, what are your friends' dating relationships like? And then get into the more probing questions, such as, hey, what are some behaviors that would be okay in a dating relationship? And what are some that you might have a problem with? You might even ask, have you ever seen any kind of abusive behavior between a couple of your peers at school who are going out? And then I truly think it's important to ask even deeper questions. For example, why do you think one person might abuse someone that they've professed love towards? And also, why might a person stay in an abusive relationship? And I think that over time, the child will then begin to realize that, my goodness, my parents are sort of in the know related to this sort of stuff. They're not judging or criticizing me. They're just wanting to have open, candid dialogue about these topics. And now I know that I can come to them and they're not going to fly off the handle if I have to deal with this personally.
What about schools? What role does the school play in helping students not just deal with the abuse, but in cultivating these relationships? Is this something that educators should be doing?
Absolutely. February is Teen Dating Violence Awareness Month. And so I'm thankful that more attention is given to this topic during this month. But I'll also say that in schools, we seem to disproportionately focus on bullying and cyberbullying and sexting. And I think those are incredibly important topics. You know, I spend my professional life focusing on them, but it doesn't feel like we're talking about healthy relationships as much as we should. And so educational programs in schools, research has shown that they can change belief systems around dating violence online and offline as they focus on reducing rape myth acceptance and gender violence acceptance. Plus, I think these programs play a big role in emboldening bystanders to provide support for friends. If my best friend or even someone that I know in my class is in a relationship, but I see that they're not being treated really well, yeah, I could mind my own business and keep my head down, but I hope that we compel students to action whenever they see any form of victimization. And then finally, we want schools and educators to teach youth how to stay safe in romantic relationships, not just physical safety, but also online. They can use the blocks and the filters and the report function on social media to get help. And we don't ever want them to feel helpless because there's usually a solution if they'll reach out to the right person.
Earlier, you gave me an example of, you know, what that abuse might be like is if you take somebody's phone and you're looking through to see what they're doing. You're breaking into their privacy. But when it comes to parents and teachers, is there a line of privacy? Because, you know, we have to be watching what our kids are doing. As a parent, I want to see, you know, where are my kids going online? As a teacher, and we talked about this, educators seeing what young people are doing online, because sometimes that may be a clue as to, you know, violent activity. Where's the line for parents and educators on passing that privacy to see what's really going on?
Sure. When it comes to educators, I would encourage that they just sort of keep their ear to the ground and hear about rumblings and rumors and issues across the student body rather than invade the privacy of a phone. They don't have that level of immunity to go through another device unless there are specific rules and policy violations in the discipline manual. I would get law enforcement involved. I would get an administrator involved if necessary, in order to do those sorts of investigations. I think they should rather focus on prevention. And then when you're thinking about parents, I would say that many parents should have the ability to go through their child's phone. If their child is young, their child should give them passwords. You should know the lock code of your child's phone so that you can open it up every so often to do spot checks. Not that you have the time to do a spot check and go through their camera roll or read in careful detail all of the texts, but every so often, there should be some sort of deterrent presence in you being able to do that. There's also software that's available that can help a little bit, but software is a short-term solution, and a better solution would be to continue to have a great relationship with your kids so that they come to you whenever they deal with anything unpleasant or uncomfortable or creepy.
And we talk about parents and teachers and their role, but what about peers? And I wondered, you know, if young people having these kind of conversations with their peers is helpful.
I feel like peers can have very important conversations with their friends, but I'll also say that maybe those peers are not really receiving the best messages from the models that we have in society. Maybe those peers don't have a great relationship that they're witnessing in their home between their mom and their dad, for example. Maybe they're not getting the best models from, again, reality television or celebrity culture. So I just hope that it's quality advice as these peers are pouring into their friends. And I think the big picture would be, yes, we want youth to step up. If your friend is struggling in any way, I hope that you pick up on that. Otherwise, I'm not really sure how involved you're in their lives, and maybe you shouldn't really be considered a friend. Check in with them, and not just check in with them to make sure that they're okay, but thankfully, I'm seeing in recent months and years a trend towards kindness. I hope that continues. Now, kindness is a difficult topic to discuss because very easily it can become lame or uncool. But as more and more influencers, as more and more youth step up and speak towards the importance of kindness, I think we can make progress in that area.
Dr. Samir Hinduja, again, is the lead author of the study Digital Dating Abuse Among a National Sample of U.S. Youth. He's also a professor in the School of Criminology and Criminal Justice at Florida Atlantic University. Dr. Hinduja, thank you so much for the time.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
And that is our program for this Wednesday, February 19th. Coming up tomorrow on the show, tonight, the Democratic presidential candidates face off in Nevada ahead of the caucuses this weekend. You may recognize one of the moderators, Telemundo's Vanessa Hawk. She's been a leading voice in environmental reporting on television and is the first environment reporter to moderate a presidential debate. We'll talk to her about what happened tonight. Plus, this week is the start of the South Beach Food and Wine Festival. We're going to learn about the newest trends in hospitality and how South Florida is a leader in the culinary field of tourism. All of that coming up tomorrow on the program. Again, remember, you can find us on WLRN.org if you want to listen to any of our old shows, or find us on iTunes. Just look up WLRN Sundial. Listen when you'd like. And we always love hearing from you. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Tell us what you think of the show or any of the topics that we should be talking about. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a wonderful day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.